It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. World Cup watch parties are going strong all over Wisconsin, with local hubs in Madison, Milwaukee, and Green Bay.
Wisconsin soccer fans have a lot more cheering to do as the U.S. men's national team takes on Turkey on Thursday in the final group stage game. And the U.S. has the knockout round locked down now after two wins with the July 1st game in Santa Clara, California.
To hear more about how Team USA is performing and what the tournament means for sports fans and the game of soccer in Wisconsin, we have Gavin Egan, the facilities manager at Redden Soccer Park and soccer coach with Region Soccer Club in Madison. Gavin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, good morning.
And Connor Kaloya is here, chief operating officer of Forward Madison FC, a professional soccer team in Madison. Connor, welcome.
Great to be here.
Connor, let's start with you. You were at the game against Australia on Friday. Tell us about what it felt like. What was the atmosphere? Oh, okay. Now you're back. We had just a little bit of delay there with your sound.
Got it. It was an amazing experience, and the most amazing sporting event I've ever attended. Just for about a mile around the stadium, just amazing energy. And then once you got in there, I think it was so loud it actually registered on the seismograph. So it was an amazing experience and a really awesome day for American soccer.
Do you think that energy, that electricity, helped the team in some way?
Absolutely. No, it was, I mean, there was a good showing from the Australian fans, but absolute home field advantage. You know, as the Star Spangled Banner finished, there was a flyover. It felt like a home game for sure. And you could feel the players seemed very confident and at ease from the kick. And I think it absolutely helped the U.S. team.
Gavin, has World Cup fever hit the U.S.? Like, what was your reaction to Friday?
I mean, securing a spot in the knockout stage so early is great. It means you can rest players. So, yeah, I think we're pretty excited as soccer fans.
You can rest players. We still, though, don't have Christian Pulisic. What do you see in not having the midfielder there, the star?
I mean, obviously, it'd be better to have him than not, but being able to rest him going into a knockout stage and maybe get him back for that game would be great.
Mm. So, Connor, Chris Brady, a keeper for Team USA, was once loaned to Forward Madison back in 2021. What's it been like watching this goalkeeper rise through the ranks?
It's been awesome to see him grow up. When he was with us, he was just 16 years old, had an amazing season with us. And, you know, even at the age of 16, he acted like he was far beyond his years. He acted like he's probably 25, 26 years old, mature, just a great kid. And to watch his progression, to have success in Major League Soccer, and now to be on the U.S. men's national team, it's amazing to see, and it's well-deserved. You love seeing good people have success, and he's a great kid. And great to see him out there on the pitch on Friday.
And so homegrown with that Illinois upbringing, Naperville, it seems like it gets closer to us here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, he's just a good Midwestern kid, totally humble, extremely talented, but, does it the right way both on and off the field.
Okay, so Gavin, Esmir Baraktarvic, Appleton native, nicknamed the Milwaukee Messi, playing for Bosnia-Herzegovina. Can you tell us about his play in Wisconsin and what it's been like to see him on the World Cup stage?
What I know of him, I've learned through my workers that played against him, and they hold him in high regard. They were really excited when he secured the spot against Italy.
In a shootout at the end of the game.
Yeah. I think it shows how it's part of the beauty in America, actually. Like, he had a safe spot to go after his parents fled that war and in Europe, and, you know, rose to the ranks in the Revolution Academy, and then popped over to PSV, and has just been raising, succeeding ever since. And so, yeah, I think it's just nice to see someone from our area succeed by any means necessary.
And Gavin, as a soccer coach and with kids around you, what does it mean for these young kids to watch people from Wisconsin on the world stage?
I think it's just great to see the kids see what they're able to do. It kind of plants great seeds for them so that they can continue to grow and play and dream. I know that's what I did when I was playing. Like when I was little, I had a different type of mullet back then, like watching different players, an older Argentinian that has since passed play.
We're talking about Wisconsin in the World Cup, and we have Gavin Egan with us, facilities manager at Redden Soccer Park and soccer coach with Regent Soccer Club in Madison. Connor Kaloya is here, chief operating officer of Forward Madison FC. Connor, in the 90s, the running sentiment was that soccer ranked 67th among the nation's favorite sports, behind tractor pulls. How has Wisconsin enthusiasm for the sport changed over time? What have you seen?
Well, I think we've climbed the ranks. I don't think we're 67th anymore. I think if you come to a Forward Madison game and see 3,500, 4,000, 4,500 fans cheering on their local team, or even our new women's team, Rally Madison FC, averaging about 3,000 fans a game, I think it's proof that locally and throughout the state, there's great enthusiasm for the game. And, 32 years ago in the World Cup was here the last time, soccer's taken a huge leap since then. And I think, this World Cup being on American soil is getting even more people, both young and old, into the game that maybe weren't really exposed to it previously.
Do you think it's going to impact your organizations, your turnout in Madison?
Yeah, I think long term it will. I think it'll get more kids playing. And with the expanded World Cup, 48 teams, even in the early rounds here, every game is interesting and every game has people watching it. And so I think there's a lot of people maybe weren't soccer fans before that are finally kind of turning and getting interested in it and hopefully want to check it out from a local perspective as well.
So Gavin, Team USA's first game in the World Cup against Paraguay drew record-breaking audience, more than 27.5 million viewers in English and Spanish. Why are these games so significant to people across the world?
I mean, it just speaks to it. I mean, if you want to think about soccer and you haven't looked at it before, it's a language. Like, if you play it, you speak it, you just speak it with a different accent than someone else who plays it in a different country. And so it resonates with people all around the world. Like, and you can play it with just a ball in a rocky field or on a grass pitch, like, or on a manicured turf pitch and at the highest level. So like anybody can play, it's very accessible. And once you play it, you can go anywhere and play pickup. I've been able to play pickup luckily throughout Central America and South America with all different types of people. And I might not have been able to speak with them like with my words, but I could play, you know? And so that's why I think it resonates with people. It's just a way of accessing people. And you can see it in the different types of fans that come. I don't know if Connor saw any of that in Seattle, but you can see it if you're out at the bar and watching a game. You'll run into all different types of people watching, and that's your access point with them.
Connor, what do you make of the universal language of soccer?
Yeah, I mean, I think a great example from Seattle was, I was fortunate to bring my 9-year-old son with me. Went to the game as we're walking back to the train station. There was a pub outside the pub. They had two nets and a little turf. And my son played for 2 hours with kids from across the U.S., but from Australia and across the world. And there was a little post-match U.S. versus Australia going on with 3 or 4 Australian kids in their yellow jerseys taking on my son and just a couple kids that he just met 5 minutes ago. And, after that, later that night, I asked him what was the highlight of the day, thinking, it might have been a U.S. win or one of the goals. The highlight of his day was playing pickup with these kids from Australia and across the U.S. In front of a bar, on the streets of Seattle.
A 9-year-old who will never forget that moment.
Yeah, no, it was, awesome, both the game, but then also just kind of, as Gavin's saying, the language of soccer bridges so many different countries and cultures.
Okay, so looking forward here, Gavin, Paraguay, Australia, you know, good teams. What does the U.S. have in these next stages and in the knockout round that it has to gear up for?
I mean, if they I think they're to the top of the group, which I think they are, they might actually play Esme. I'm not sure, but in that knockout round, I think it's just getting people healthy, resting players. I think this is going to be the narrative of the next week or so. Pochettino, the coach, has them firing on all cylinders. It's really fun to see them play, especially when they broke down the low block of Paraguay. Like, you know, that's a hard thing to do. If you even if you are the more talented squad, to break down a low block is a very hard thing to do. Healthy. So it's fun to see him play that now.
Okay, so Connor, healthy, rested, momentum. What will it take in these next games?
Yeah, I think just keep doing what they've been doing. You know, I think the athleticism, you know, the American athleticism that we see in so many sports is you're seeing that now in soccer with this team. And just amazing athletes that can compete on the world stage. And Coach Tino's done a great job from a tactical perspective and technical perspective. And I'm excited to just keep seeing them do what they've been doing. And, you know, could end up being a great run.
Well, Connor and Gavin, thank you so much for joining us. Happy watching. Happy watch parties.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah.
Gavin Egan is the facilities manager at Redden Soccer Park and soccer coach with Regent Soccer Club in Madison. And Connor Kaloya is chief operating officer of Forward Madison FC. It's a professional soccer team based in Madison. We've been talking about the impact of the World Cup on Wisconsin soccer fans and young players of the sport on teams around the state.
A new affordable housing development opens in Milwaukee with hundreds of units. Find out how it came to be.
We look to deliver our last building August of 26. We delivered our first one August of 25, and we're about 50% leased up, so it's going quite well.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Corliss Housing Development in Milwaukee is now renting units. The apartments are located on property that once contained an old landfill and some vacant buildings.
Eventually, the Corliss will contain 576 apartments, including 144 for seniors in 8 buildings. All of the units are reserved for households making no more than 80% of the area's median income.
While the development was supported with tax cuts and some public funding, it is considered the largest private affordable housing development in state history. To find out how it came together, we have the project's developer. S.R. Mills is CEO of Bear Development. That's the Kenosha-based company that owns and manages real estate property around the country. S.R., welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Your company has housing developments all over the country. What makes the Corliss in Milwaukee unique?
Well, it's unique from a lot of levels. One of them is its size. At 576 units, it's the largest single housing development that we've done, and it's actually the largest affordable housing development in the state's history.
Leasing is underway, I understand. People have started moving in. Are the units filling? What do you see?
Yeah, they are. You know, it's actually 8 buildings over about a 10-acre property. And right now, we're about halfway through the leasing process. We look to deliver our last building August of 26. We delivered our first one August of 25. And we're about 50% leased up, so it's going quite well.
The project, it cost more than $185 million to put together, and you utilized bank loans and tax incremental financing. You used a Milwaukee Brownfield loan and National Housing Trust funds, among other sources. Was this project more complicated to put together than your other developments?
Well, they're all complicated, but this one certainly had its perils. We originally looked at utilizing historic tax credits and trying to redevelop what was an old industrial complex. And COVID hit, costs went up, and we had to rethink and reimagine the project in general.
How did you do that? What were the steps you took?
It was really looking at the available sources that were in the marketplace, and then financial sources, that is, and then also looking at the demand in the neighborhoods of really what we wanted to achieve and what we thought would be good for the community. The alder of the district, Alderwoman Dmitrievich, was instrumental in looking at it and assisting us with deciding that there should be a senior component, a family component, to really make it a full community.
A senior component. Can you talk a little bit about designating some of this housing specifically for seniors?
Sure. What we learned through a process of working with the neighborhood, the city staff, the alder of the district, was that there really wasn't a lot of dedicated senior housing in the neighborhood. Oftentimes, a senior would age out of the neighborhood, need assistance, and then have to leave. And so we thought it very important to allocate 144 of the 576 units for senior housing.
So you mentioned COVID hit, costs go up, but zooming out now to the broader economy, SR, are tariffs and inflation and rising energy costs impacting housing construction?
They are, certainly. I think, you know, while we've accounted for much of that and some of the, you know, expected spikes in cost, really the interest rates are what's instrumental now and very difficult to put your thumb on as to where they're going to be. These, you know, the gestation time for these projects, or we don't look at it in months, we look at it in years. So it's always tough to guess where the interest rates are going to be a few years out.
When you're putting together these, you know, intricate funding mechanisms, are those obstacles to developing affordable housing, or is it more of the larger piece, like interest rates?
Well, I think they all coincide. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes back to interest rates, which, because there's a fixed amount of rent that comes in with, you know, the amount of debt that it could support, and then in turn, also the available funding sources that can change from time to time. And then certainly the costs, whether it's land cost or hard construction costs, that certainly factors into it as well.
The project site, it contained an old landfill. What is involved in removing that to prepare for a development?
Yeah, and actually this site wasn't as bad as many. Foundry sand is something that's very common in Milwaukee. So from an environmental standpoint, we've certainly dealt with worse. But, you know, certainly you have to be very thoughtful and work with the DNR and all of the various officials and environmental consultants to put down the necessary vapor mitigation, go ahead and extract any of the hazardous materials that might or might not be there, and then put the necessary caps down to ensure that there isn't any penetration of those caps to keep everybody safe and any contaminants in the ground so they can dilute over time.
And that can take time as well to make those extra steps.
It certainly can, time and money.
Developers sometimes encounter NIMBYism from neighbors who don't want new development next door or across the street. Have you encountered this with the Corliss?
You know, actually with the Corliss, it was, you know, I think a lot of people, including, you know, our team, myself, we really wanted to save many of the existing buildings. Mm. However, it was becoming financially unviable. So what we heard was, you know, they wanted density. They wanted to create a neighborhood feel, wanted amenities such as the bike trail through the site and to make sure it feels like the balance of the neighborhood. So as far as the NIMBYism, we didn't encounter much. It was more so just making sure it's the right product for the area.
Were you surprised that you kind of had the opposite of that? Yes, we want the density here. Is that something you encounter in other places?
You know, we encounter it more in urban areas where there's an appreciation for, you know, keeping, you know, having great parks, having great outdoor space, but putting density where it is appropriate. Where we run into more of the traditional NIMBYism is in some of the suburban and rural areas. And while there's many instances where we have, you know, great partners and neighbors there, but usually there's more of an education process about, you know, what we're doing, and that change isn't, well, it can always be scary, it isn't bad, and we just try and do our best to explain it.
And there's certainly trust involved as well, I'm sure. What can the state, what can municipalities do to encourage more of this type of affordable housing?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, in the city of Milwaukee has done a great job on predictable zoning. That's something that, you know, we actually acquired the site prior to having our completed plans and the necessary permits, but we did so because we knew what was allowed by right. And so we were comfortable doing that, which allowed us to stay on a relatively tight time frame. And then really the predictable TIF assistance as well. For many of these developments, there needs to be a public-private partnership, and knowing what that looks like on the front end allows us to take one variable out of the mix and factor it into the overall project.
Do you see opportunities for other developments of this size in Wisconsin and this type?
I do. I mean, granted, this is a large development, but it's over 8 buildings and 10 acres in an urban site in a great neighborhood. You know, I think we just always have to be thoughtful of not overbuilding and also not underbuilding. So while I think there are opportunities for comparable size developments, it needs to be the right fit, not just big for the sake of being big.
So do the research.
Yeah, exactly.
SR, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
S.R. Mills is CEO of Bear Development, which is the developer of The Corliss in Milwaukee. It will have 576 affordable units and 8 buildings. Now, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority administers the state's low-income housing tax credit program and oversees a system for scoring the impact of a housing project on Wisconsin residents. It's called a QAP, or Qualified Allocation Plan. For more on this type of housing effort, we turn to Elmer Moore Jr., CEO and Executive Director of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Elmer, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to speak to you today, Kate.
You've said that this project required just the right combination of luck, of timing, of capacity and collaboration. And Wisconsin desperately needs affordable housing and workforce housing. Why are these projects so difficult to build?
Well, for a multitude of reasons, including they are incredibly expensive. At this point, with the supply chain, labor costs, and in fact, the cost of capital being just so high, the per unit cost reaches well into the hundreds of thousands. And when you multiply hundreds of thousands times nearly 500, you get to, or excuse me, nearly 600, mm-hmm. you get to numbers that are truly astronomical. It's difficult for developers to secure the necessary capital, and it's difficult for municipalities and other funders to arrange all the right approvals and necessary resources to make these kinds of deals happen. So we're so proud of what Bear is doing and impressed, because this is a very, very important development.
It makes me wonder, you know, how do you get banks on board to lend enough and take bigger risks on housing projects like this one with over 500 units?
The risk in lending to developers is more about the abilities of the developer to deliver the housing units and to operate them in a way that is safe, sound, and secure. There is very little risk investing in housing itself, because it is absolutely necessary. We are undersupplied by tens of thousands of units, even in just the Milwaukee area alone. And so the opportunity to generate a return offering debt to developers is a pretty safe bet, so long as the developer, like SR Mills and Bear Development, have a track record of delivering on their plans. And what we love to see is communities also investing in the developments that they so desperately need. So You see that in the form of housing funds. You see that in the form of TIF funds being directed towards housing development. But it's a safe bet for a community, and we'd love to assure more lenders and banking institutions around the idea that it's a safe bet for their balance sheets as well.
We also heard from S.R. Mills, who did say that the one thing that would help developers like him is predictable zoning. When developers have a clear idea of what's allowed before they buy property, are you seeing municipalities being more flexible and open to these larger developments?
Yes. The one place that I might correct his comments is it is one of the things mm-hmm. that would make this process much easier. We're seeing communities across the state really take a more proactive approach to making themselves accommodating to developments writ large, and certainly larger and larger developments. If you can imagine, you know, 576 units invites something closer to 2,000, 2,500 people to a neighborhood who might not have resided there before. It materially changes how a community feels. And so it should be taken very seriously. But municipalities must develop zoning plans and housing plans that incorporate these large-scale developments and the amenities that they support. Grocery stores, bike trails, you know, changes to traffic and so on. Because when we do that, we can really assure a clearer path towards success for that municipality.
The Corliss is considered the largest private affordable housing project in Wisconsin at the moment, but there have been large public housing projects like West Lawn Gardens in Milwaukee. Do you see private or public housing better able to provide affordable housing? Like, which way is preferable now?
There's an easy answer to this question. When prioritizing investments in public housing and investments in private affordable housing, the answer is yes. We need thousands more of everything. And so the processes for developing them doesn't truly overlap. And so we don't have to make that choice. They offer some different resources. Certainly public housing has the ability to employ resources that come from the federal government in a way that a lot of private development doesn't. Tax credits are one thing in the capital stack, but direct funding from whether it's block grant or others of the myriad capital sources, we need all hands on deck. We need all dollars directed towards generating housing that people can afford, whether it's public, private, or otherwise.
Looking at the broader economy now, we've got tariffs. You mentioned interest rates. Energy costs are also driving up the cost of construction. What can state government do to help developers deal with these higher costs and keep encouraging housing construction?
Well, you know, there's layers of government, and each layer has its own set of responsibilities and opportunities for improvement. At the state, you know, we're working on our qualified allocation plan, which is the governing document that dictates how we allocate tax credits. And we hope to be announcing the approval and the publishing of that very, very soon. What we want to do in the QAP is make sure that we're making it possible for capital stacks to work. We want to make sure that we are requiring the development of housing that is appropriate for communities, appropriate for families, appropriate for people with different physical and other needs. And so that's one of the things that we can do at the WETA level. At the county and municipal level, we would love to see some easing of some zoning processes. We want to encourage the increase in density in a lot of communities so that people can have close access to amenities, grocery stores, education, workforce development programs, and so on. We encourage the use of TIF funding and discrete housing trust funds that are raised by counties and municipalities, and that fill an important gap left by existing resources. And then finally, I think all of us have the ability to encourage unlikely partnerships. You know, Bear Development convened a huge array of stakeholders to make this project happen, including things like the Harbor District, including folks from the city of Milwaukee, Walker's Point Association. It took everyone to actually cross this exciting finish line.
Also to note that a portion of these units, 144, designated for seniors. Do you see access issues specifically for senior citizens?
Yeah, there's definitely a need to make strategic investments to support seniors and also individuals and families with different physical accessibility needs. And we can accomplish a great deal by making sure that our building code and in fact our QAP has accessibility as a primary concern built into it. But we definitely need to be very thoughtful and conscientious about matching the product to the community's needs. Seniors, you know, there's more concern than just the physical needs. There's a different sense of social engagement. There's different amenities that become important, things like healthcare, things like community centers. And we have to just really be thoughtful and strategic in how we design these things.
Elmer, thank you for joining us.
It's truly my pleasure. It's always a great day to talk about housing that's being developed for the communities that need it. Thank you.
That is Elmer Moore Jr., CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Earlier, we heard from real estate developer S.R. Mills, whose firm developed a large affordable housing complex in Milwaukee called the Corliss, with hundreds of apartments.
Coming up, the first Hmong families arrived in Eau Claire a half century ago. A new documentary features their stories of making a life in the Chippewa Valley.
The basis of what I thought I knew about Hmong people and my neighbors in the community, frankly, was mostly incorrect.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. During the Vietnam War, the CIA recruited tens of thousands of Hmong boys and men to serve as proxy soldiers in what later became known as the Secret War.
Many Hmong people lost their lives in the war, while others fled for safety, making a dangerous swim across the Mekong River to escape to refugee camps in Thailand.
From there, more than 100,000 Hmong people were resettled throughout the United States, including in Wisconsin. The first Hmong families arrived in Eau Claire in 1976, 50 years ago this year.
To commemorate the anniversary, the staff at a multimedia company in Eau Claire created a documentary film featuring the stories of local Hmong refugees who made a life for themselves in the Chippewa Valley.
McKenna Shear is the managing editor, and Alex Barber is video and photo director for Volume 1 in Eau Claire. They're the filmmakers behind A Half Century Home, 50 Years of Hmong Resettlement in Eau Claire. And Chong Chang He is a retired pastor and owner of Hmong American Insurance Services in Eau Claire. He's one of the storytellers featured in the film. They joined us last month from WPR's Eau Claire studio. McKenna, take us back 50 years to the beginning of this story when Hmong people first started coming to Eau Claire. You saw there's a lot of misunderstanding among the local culture over who these people were. What did you learn in doing this documentary about the first Hmong families who called Eau Claire home?
I learned so much, and I preface that a bit with saying that I grew up in Eau Claire. I was born in Chippewa Falls. I grew up in Eau Claire. I went through the school district here, graduated from high school here before I went to college in another state. I mention that because the basis of what I thought I knew about Hmong people and my neighbors in the community, frankly, was mostly incorrect. And I think that is a bit parallel with maybe what folks knew about the Vietnam War during the time. You were served a particular picture of the Vietnam War. And in, oh my gosh, I don't know, dozens and dozens of newspaper clips and radio recordings that I listened to or read, there was little or zero mention of the word Hmong. People were referred, were referring to folks as Vietnamese or Thai, because I think that even reporters who may have been potentially on the ground or were specifically reporting on the war, they did not know about the Hmong people. They did not know about the culture, and they at largely did not know about the secret war either. So I think what I really learned through that history was even to today, even to when I was going to school in Eau Claire 15, 20 years ago, we still weren't directly saying those words or exploring that specific history. The goal here for me and for us was to attempt to condense a 50-year history, not possible, but to attempt to do so based on talking to people in real life who actually are our neighbors and live here and lived this, and then parse together that educational history and true history together into one place that hopefully is accessible for people in a free, accessible way.
And before we meet one of those neighbors, Alex, I want to hear from you as the video director at Volume One. What was your approach to taking these modern day interviews, that archival material that McKenna was just talking about, and putting that all together to tell the visual story here?
Yeah, I think what became immediately apparent is that we needed to hear the story directly from people. So not having so much overhead with video production, not trying to make it flashy or fancy, we just want to hear directly from people what they have to say about the situation, which usually meant that we would go to a place that was familiar to people we were interviewing. So houses, businesses, grocery stores, any place that people would feel comfortable, and we would just talk. We'd talk for upwards of, one of our interviews lasted for almost 3 hours, which also was being translated in real time as well. We wanted to hear people's story directly using the Hmong language. We ended up getting a lot of footage from people that we had talked to, but even more footage and pictures and stuff was just so hard to access. We talked to a lot of people in the community who had even said, you know, we didn't think that this film or this tape that we had would be relevant anymore, so we threw it away. We didn't keep it. So a lot of people's history and family life growing up, for many people, is gone. That also led us to reach out to a lot of universities. I had reached out to some people in Laos and Thailand to try to get some more pictures and some more information. We actually ended up working with a professor from UW-Madison who graciously allowed us to use an entire collection of over 8,000 images that they had to help tell that story of resettlement, of having to escape Laos to Thailand and then Thailand to the U.S.
I want to bring Chong into it now. Chong, you share your story in the documentary. You came to the United States by yourself when you were 18, first in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then eventually in Eau Claire. You'd been through this horrible, traumatic experience, arrived in this new place by yourself. What are your first memories of arriving in the Midwest?
Back in our country, we don't have a snow. I think in April 24, when I first came to America, and I see snow, and this is very cold, even though in April still very cold, but I not prepared for it, you know. So that is the first thing, and it's still in my mind today. And also, we see a lot of, especially one of my cousins told me that when I came to Fort Wayne, and then immediately right after that, they left to Iowa. Left me alone. And he told me that he gave me a nickel. I think he said, if you need a taxi or a drink, you just go to here and you drop the coin through here, and then taxi will be coming. And I never thought that going to happen, you know, until I try. So those two things that are still on my mind today.
At one point, Chong, in the documentary, you talk about how it's important for Hmong people to learn about this history. Why was that so important for you?
Well, because the younger generation, I call them is the lost generation, because they really don't know who they are and where they are coming from. And most of them, they just thought that it just happened here. So they happen just be here, you know, but they don't know the history that their parents struggled through in the past. So that's why it's very important. I usually tell them, the younger generation, that they need to know who they are and where they are coming from. So if you don't know your history, you will not be able to, you know, to live in the present time. And if you don't know your present time, you will not be able to prepare for future. So that is very important to know who you are and where you're coming from. So that is very important, yeah.
We're talking about a new documentary film called A Half Century Home, 50 Years of Hmong Resettlement in Eau Claire. Chong Chang-he, retired pastor, he shares his story in the documentary. We also have the filmmakers, McKenna Shear and Alex Barber from Volume 1. McKenna, talking to people, as you mentioned, in their homes and in other comfortable spaces, they shared really powerful stories. Coming here, the flight from Laos, bullying and beatings in Eau Claire. What was it like to have people bearing their souls in some ways, in ways maybe they aren't used to doing?
Absolutely. I think, firstly, I'd like to say that we also laughed a lot during these interviews and at events that we went to hang out with families and people. There was so much, as I mentioned before, going in that I thought I knew or preconceptions that I did not know that I had until I'm sitting with people and having conversations. And some of those things include, like you said, my only focusing on what I thought were going to be horrible stories, true stories, painful stories. And while that's true, and that's vital and important to understanding that history and understanding our neighbors, you have to acknowledge the joy and the success and the laughter of our Hmong neighbors. I mean, I've laughed so much with everybody. And so I wanted to say that first and foremost. Of course, as Alex mentioned, our interviews generally range between 1.5 to 3+ hours. They were in person with folks. I think all of them were, including with some kiddos. And that looked like me asking questions, I think, that maybe the average person wouldn't want to ask, that maybe are uncomfortable, and that is a barrier to understanding each other, right? You don't want to make somebody uncomfortable, or you feel too uncomfortable to ask questions. What I did was try to ask the questions that felt open-ended enough to just start a conversation. A great example of that is when we chatted with Blia Schwan. I think I asked her one question, and then she told me 45 minutes worth. She walked me through these different chapters of her life.
I always tell people that I feel like I've lived like three different lifetimes, just because Laos was so different, and then Thailand was very different, and then coming here to the U.S. was very different.
People just want to be asked, I think. I think people just want somebody to care enough to ask. I think everybody can relate to that in some way. But that's another big takeaway I had.
Chong, the documentary ends with a message that, you know, Hmong people, they've built a community in Eau Claire and the surrounding area, but they're also part of the Eau Claire community. They're neighbors. Can you talk a little bit about how you feel now, so many decades later, living in Eau Claire as part of that community?
Yes, because we came to America as a refugee, meaning that we will never go back or we don't have any other way. So when we came to America, I usually telling people that we are here and that we'll stay here and we'll be here. So we need to have an education so we can help, you know, support the city where we live in. And we need to be a good citizen and to help the city and then also the state and also the federal level. And in order to do that, we need to be a good citizen, you know, work hard and support yourself and support your community. So I'm so proud to be in Eau Claire here, especially the Chippewa Valley here, because we have a lot of people here that, like I said, after the, we've been here for a long time, and I think we've been knowing each other, so we've been helping each other. So I think, yeah, we are here to stay, and we'll never have anywhere to go. So we need to be a good citizen and support ourselves in helping the community.
Alex, the documentary now has been out in the world for a few weeks. What kind of response have you gotten from viewers in Eau Claire and from the Hmong community so far?
Yeah, I think overall the response has been incredible. We've had tons of people send us emails, come into our offices and say, you know, thank you so much for doing this. We had no idea this was part of our history. We've heard a lot from the Hmong community as well that this seems to be touching younger generations, that people are interested in wanting to learn more. And then also, too, that for many people that have been in the situation like Dr. Herr had been in, where you deal with a traumatic event, it's very hard for people to open up and talk about those things. And along with some other events that have happened in the community, this documentary has also helped to start some of those conversations with people that the younger generation is asking their grandparents, you know, did this happen to you? Tell me your story. It's something that, you know, starting out in this project, we had no idea. Like McKenna said, we had no idea what we were getting into. But I think in a very positive way, we also had no idea how positive the response would be and how much people were wanting to hear this story, to see their stories and lives be put up on screen and to be understood, not just in Eau Claire, but I think, you know, nationally as well.
And Chung, has this documentary, being part of it and watching it, has this helped start conversations maybe with younger Hmong people in Eau Claire?
Yes, the majority of the young people, they still don't understand. So they have to learn from the beginning because, like I said, when they grow up here, you know, they thought they just happened to be here, but they never know the history. So, yeah, a lot of people, they talking to me, they say, yeah, we wish we know, you know, earlier. So I think everybody, especially the younger generation, is something new for them too. So hopefully they will take those and, know who they are and especially appreciate the parents what they did in the past.
That's a great place to leave it. Chung, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Alex and McKenna, thanks for sharing this documentary with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was McKenna Scheer, Managing Editor of Volume 1, and Alex Barber, Video and Photo Director for Volume 1. Also, we heard from Chong Chang Her, retired pastor based in Eau Claire. We spoke with him last month about the new documentary film called A Half Century Home, 50 Years of Hmong Resettlement in Eau Claire. That's available to watch for free at volume1.org, and the film is available with Hmong subtitles. Some people are following the ups and downs of the World Cup. Other people are following one of the rarest spectacles in the plant kingdom. It's unfolding at the Mitchell Park Domes in Milwaukee.
That's right. The corpse flower named Penelope is about to bloom, and it could happen as soon as this week in the Tropical Dome.
According to the Milwaukee Domes Alliance, Penelope, in all her towering magnificence and powerful odor, last bloomed 2 years ago.
And once a corpse flower opens, we have at most 2 days to see the bloom before it begins to fade.
Do you have a story to share about seeing one of these corpse flowers bloom or smelling one of them bloom? There are a few around Wisconsin. Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can call or text to get in touch. Either way, that number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Brad Kohlberg and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.